Welcome to episode 4 of season 2 of The Meridian. Once again, we are recording at Lund Observatory in Sweden, and we are releasing this episode on March 25th. Crossing our local meridian today, we are lucky to have Dinah Stravins, a professor emeritus here, who studies stellar surfaces. This season, we are also bringing you some field reporting from the Nordic Optical Telescope on La Palma. It is not easy to observe with an active volcano covering everything with ash and lava, but more about that later.
The meridian.
Hey Rebecca.
Hi Nick.
How are you?
I'm actually quite excited. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Why are you excited?
It's actually so that ESO is turning 60 this year.
Happy birthday.
Probably shouldn't sing.
Okay. ESO, what does that stand for?
It stands for European Southern Observatory, which are a collaboration of European countries that got together and started building observatories in the Southern Hemisphere.
Oh, okay. So like the telescopes in Chile?
Yeah, exactly. In Chile, in the Paranal, in the Atacama Desert. So we, for instance, have the VLT.
Yep.
And the ELT that's being built, and ALMA telescope.
Right, okay. So a whole bunch that are down there.
Yeah, and all of those are part of ESO.
Right, okay, cool. So is there anything happening with this 60th birthday that ESO is
having? Yes. Yep. So ESO are planning to arrange a bunch of virtual events during late summer and early autumn.
Right.
Details are not really quite out yet, yep. But they promised that they will post them on ESO.org, so we'll keep an eye on there.
Cool, right. Is there anything else?
Well, I'm guessing that there might be a lot of celebrations in Garching, which is their headquarters that they have here in Europe, in Germany. Mm-hmm. Perhaps at their supernova planetarium. And also here in Lund, we will be celebrating during World Space Week. But as I said, look for details on ESO.org, because I think there will be celebrations all over Sweden.
Right. And if you can't get out anywhere, is there any other options that, you know, are available to you?
Yeah, they said that they would do live tours of the facilities on Facebook.
Right, cool.
So, yeah. So the thing is that Sweden is actually one of the 5 founding members of ESO.
Right. Who are the other 4?
Germany, yep. France, Belgium, and the Netherlands.
Right. Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. Which is how we are part of it. So, and how we can, you know, collaborate with having the telescopes there. For instance, we have Diane from a few episodes back, who's part of this Foremost collaboration. Right. And that's part of ESO.
Okay, so that's ESO, mm-hmm. right? So I sometimes hear ESA with an A.
Yeah.
What's the difference between those?
Exactly. So ESA is the European Space Agency.
Right.
And they also have telescopes, but they're mostly up in space. So for instance, Gaia, that Paul talked about.
Oh, okay, cool.
Mm.
Right. And didn't you apply to be an astronaut?
Yes, exactly. So ESA is a way of Europe's NASA in a way. They have astronauts, they have satellites and space telescopes, and it's also a collaboration of European countries that's gone together to do, well, space science.
Right, okay, cool. Yeah, well, they really need to work on the astronaut application program, because they're, you know, filtering out the wrong people.
No, exactly. And in Sweden, we're part of ESA, then the space agency, through our Swedish space agency called Rymdstyrelsen.
So right,
that's how we're an active member of that, and have Gaia, for instance.
Yeah, okay, so it's ESO, European Southern Observatory, and then ESA, European Space Agency.
Yes, any questions, Mark, left?
One.
Okay.
Why do we want to observe in the Southern Hemisphere?
Sure, that's a good question. And I actually thought we could ask our guest coming into this episode, Dinah Stravins, about it.
Oh, okay.
So let's invite him to the mic.
Sure thing.
So welcome, Dinah. I'm super happy to have you here.
Thanks.
So, could you tell us a bit about yourself? Because you've been here at the observatory for quite some time, right?
Yes, and actually I started in Lund quite some time ago, actually by arranging to be born here.
Oh!
So that's my first encounter with Lund. Yes, mm-hmm. I've been here quite some time, and nowadays I'm sort of working mainly on research as a senior astronomer, spending most of my time in Lund, but also with various interludes elsewhere.
Yes, okay. And what kind of science are you doing?
I'm mainly working to analyze spectra of the sun, spectra of stars, methods of precise observations, methods to make the ultimate in spectroscopy to search for other planets, to understand the fine details on stellar surfaces, and to look for what are the frontiers maybe 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah, because I've heard that you're sort of looking into methods of finding another Earth. Is that even possible?
Yes, nothing is impossible. Things are just more or less difficult. You may encounter now and then headlines in the media that a so-called Earth-like planet has been found. Mm. But that's not really true. Well, it's not fake news either, but it's sort of incomplete. What has been found are planets maybe the size of the Earth, the temperature of the Earth, or maybe one where the host star is something like our sun. But to find a real Earth twin, an exo-Earth, that is a planet the size of the Earth, moving in an orbit about 1 year around its star, its solar-like star, in about a year of period, and so on, that has never been done and is currently not possible. And mm-hmm. that is a big challenge.
Right, and that's something you're looking into.
Yes, because the methods to find such a planet include, for example, looking at the slight wobble that a star is experiencing as the planet is pulling on it by its gravity. But the effect is so tiny for an Earth-like planet, so that it's been very difficult to get the precision in measurements to get it. But we are there now. We could measure it if the star was shining like a stabilized laser. But it isn't. The light from the star is diffuse. The spectrum of the star is broadened. It is perturbed by everything that happens on the star.
Mm.
The star is boiling. It's oscillating. There are star spots and so on. So the challenge now is not to get higher measurement precision, but it's to understand how to get rid of all these extra effects so we can look at the true motion of the star and not just what is simmering on its surface.
Right, so it's sort of like the planet ends up in this noise that the star is producing.
Exactly. Mm. And what we're trying to do just now is to see, can we do this for the sun?
Mm-hmm.
We're observing the sun. The sun is being observed the same way as one observes stars. And this is done with tiny telescopes that are placed in the daytime outside the domes of the big telescopes, for example, on La Palma.
Mm-hmm.
And then every 5 minutes or so, there's a spectrum of the sun recorded. And this has been going on for several years. Now we have tens of thousands of such solar spectra that are always, all the time, jittering in wavelength. They are flickering in intensity. And we're trying to understand what of this jittering and flickering is due to the sun and what could possibly be due to the motion of the sun as such.
It sounds like a very ambitious project. Do you have collaborators or you do this
the
yourself?
The number of people running these things, for example, these solar telescopes, mm-hmm. is on the order of 30, 40 people.
Mm-hmm.
In this specific project, my main collaborator is a colleague who is now in Heidelberg, Germany, who actually used to be in Lund, who is providing various theoretical models that we're trying to interpret. So yes, it is a major effort. We'll have this summer a special session at the meeting about cool stars in Toulouse, mm-hmm. discussing specifically these issues of how to segregate the micro variability of stellar spectra from whatever else may be induced by planets. We'll get there. It will take time. We'll get there.
Yeah, of course. As you say, nothing is impossible. It's just various degrees of hard. So what would it mean to find an Earth 2.0?
Well, it's sort of the holy grail of exoplanet science. I mean, it's from a philosophical point of view, mm-hmm. and from an astrobiology point of view, of course, it's fundamental. Is there another Earth?
Mm.
Is there another Earth where they just now might be at a recording studio discussing things in the universe? Can we get an answer to this? I mean, this is a very profound question that goes beyond the mere astrophysical aspects. Mm. It touches upon humanity. It touches upon the view of humans in the universe.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite a big question. So I just want to take it back a bit and ask, what made you interested in astronomy?
What made me interested in astronomy? Well, difficult to pinpoint exactly. I think one contribution may have come from my father, who used to, enjoyed nature, mm-hmm. not specifically stars, perhaps, but generally creating or fostering some curiosity about the natural world. And astronomy is, well, it's cool.
It is. And also, because I was thinking that Lund Observatory is quite an old observatory, right? And it's been in Lund for, well, yeah, how many years is it?
Yes, well, there was astronomy already when the first faculty were founded in the 17th century. And yes, I was an amateur astronomer, not extremely active one, but yes, I had my own telescope. Mm-hmm. I was a member of some astronomy club. And yes, we did actually, among other activities, also visit the now old Lund Observatory. So I saw some big, well, attractive telescopes also as a young teenager. But yes, I think the road to professional astronomy came later at the university. But mm-hmm. I guess the interest was there already earlier.
So in the beginning, me and Nick talked a bit about ESO and how ESO is turning 60 this year. And I've heard that you've actually spent quite some time at the telescopes down there. So could you tell us a bit about what you know about ESO and why do we need telescopes in the Southern Hemisphere?
Okay, well, ESO, European Southern Observatory, was one of the organizations founded in the aftermath of World War II, when basically much of Europe was destroyed, and much of Europe was then rebuilding. The astronomy frontier had moved from Central Europe to United States, and the U.S. had the complete lead with the telescope at Palomar Mountain, Mount Wilson already earlier, and Europe did not have much. So in the 1950s, a number of European collaborations started. Maybe the best known is that of CERN, the Particle Physics Laboratory. They've been very successful. There were also unsuccessful attempts. For example, there was the plan to build a European electronic mathematical machine, what we today call a computer, seated in Rome. But this, of course, was overtaken by the rapid technological developments. And then there was a plan to have a joint observatory to be placed in South Africa, because already Europe had some observatories in South Africa. And so site testing, that is testing for best locations, started sometime 1960-ish or thereabouts. After some years, it was realized that the Americans were site testing in the Andes Mountains of South America. And when comparing the data, it turned out that South America was superior. The mountains of Chile had excellent conditions. And so the decision was to set up an observatory in Chile, and then European Southern Observatory was founded. The scientific motivation at the time, I think, were mainly two. The Magellanic Clouds, yes, there are two clouds, but the Magellanic Clouds, the satellite galaxies of our Milky Way galaxy, and the center of the Milky Way itself, none of which are visible or well visible from Europe. We have to recall that because at that time, there was no extragalactic astronomy in Europe. There were no telescopes that could study galaxies in seriously. So the motivation was to study stars and to get access to regions of the Milky Way and the Milky Way surroundings that were not accessible from Europe. And so things started. And then things developed, and eventually it turned out one was realizing that the efficiency of observations was so much better in Chile than in the climate of Northern Europe that basically ESO has overtaken the role of being a general observatory, not just for specifically Southern Hemisphere, but for astronomy in general. So now that is the European observatory, of course, with the other part in La Palma, but it has become a major player and a very successful one at that.
Yeah, really. So what have you done at the ESO?
Well, in recent years, I've spent a couple of months every year, every 2 years, actually not at the mountaintops, but at the offices in Santiago. ESO has headquarters in Garching by München, the sort of suburb or adjacent city to Munich. And it has the South American headquarters in Santiago, the capital of Chile. In Santiago offices, there are maybe 300 or 400 people working, maybe half of them connected with ALMA, half of them with various other ESO telescopes. So that is a place where people are coming through, where one can, on the coffee breaks, can listen to astronomers that have been observing for the previous week or so, because people go on turnos, as they're called. You turn, you go for a week on the mountain, you come back for a week in the office, you get a week off, and so on. So by being there, you can be exposed to what happens. And generally, the country that has maybe gained most from ESO is the host country of Chile. When ESO started, astronomy in Chile was very modest. Today, it is an extremely extensive and successful group. Just last month, there was the annual meeting of the Chilean Astronomical Society, and describing the extent of astronomy in Chile, there are 24 universities doing research in astronomy, 11 of those in Santiago alone. So by being in Chile, one is actually at the center of a lot of astronomy, at least that for the astronomy in the visible light, and of course also microwave, and as concerns the ALMA telescopes at Chajnantor.
Well, it sounds like a very nourishing environment if you want to do astronomy. I hope to go there someday. It sounds amazing.
Please do.
Yeah. So, as I've understood it, so Sweden are one of the founding members of ESO.
Correct.
So what involvement did we have that early on?
Early on, we can go back to when reading ESO's history in 1950s, there were discussions involving people from Lund. Knut Lundmark, who was the director here for many years, was one of the signatories of a call to erect an observatory in what was then viewed as South Africa. A document that you can see behind glass on exhibit at ESO headquarters in Garching.
Oh, wow.
And that is often called the birth certificate of ESO.
Mm-hmm.
And this was signed by the directors of many European institutes, and that sort of triggered the thing. And the idea was to build a Schmidt telescope comparable to what was then on Pelhamor, and a 3-meter-sized telescope comparable to the one then the Americans had at Lick Observatory in Mount Hamilton. This 3-meter telescope was increased in size to eventually 3.6 due to what anecdotally has been told was the experience by some, shall we say, well-built astronomer who tried the observing cage at Lick. The observing cage is something where the observer would go at the prime focus to actually be present during the observations. But this, according to the story, well-built astronomer did not fit very comfortably into the Lick cage. And that was one of the reasons why the size of the ESO telescope was increased to 3.5 meters from the original 3.
I never heard that story. Yeah, and then because we had a Lund Observatory telescope mounted next to that one.
Yes, there was on the summit of La Silla, which in Spanish normally means chair, but which actually does not have that meaning for the observatory. It means saddle, like for the horse, because if you look at the mountain from the side, it is just like a horse's saddle. Yes, next to the 3.6-meter dome, there is a more slender building, roughly the same height, and that used to contain what was called CAT, the Courier Auxiliary Telescope, an extra telescope that was used to feed starlight into the high-resolution spectrometer that is inside the big dome. And that telescope was designed by Torben Andersen, who was a telescope designer, who is a telescope designer, and who later became a professor of telescope design here in Lund.
Mm-hmm.
But that was from the earlier times of ESO. Mm.
And then also Arne Anderberg, who is also a professor emeritus here. He was, is the director of ESO?
Yes, there was a significant Swedish involvement in the early days of ESO. As directors for the telescopes on La Silla, at that time Paranal was not yet operating, there was from Uppsala, Bengt Westerlund, and Lund. From Lund, Arne Anderberg was the Chilean director for several years. So there was a significant involvement from Sweden and from Lund, especially during the first decades of ESO operations.
Right. So you mentioned it a bit that the mountains were sort of better in Chile than in South Africa. So what do you have to think about when you want to establish a telescope somewhere?
Well, the criteria have changed over time.
Okay.
Today, one is concerned more about infrared observations, which means you need to go to a very dry site, a site with very dry air, because water vapor is absorbing infrared. I mean, that's right. Why when you cook something, your microwave oven, if it is humid, it gets hot. If it's dry, it doesn't, because it doesn't absorb the microwaves.
That's why you always should add a bit of water.
Yes, precisely. Mm. But you don't want to add water if you want to observe things in the infrared. But at that time, of course, you need to have clear skies. You need a stable weather. And you also want to have good image quality. That is, you need a quiet atmosphere with a minimum of turbulence. And these sort of things occur at the west coast of continents. I mean, you find them in North American west coast, you find them in South American west coast, you find them also on African west coast. Now, the site testing went on in South Africa for a while, in the Kourou region, actually not far from where the Square Kilometer Array radio telescope is about to be built. But this was slightly further south. But Chile turned out to be better. Not everyone agreed to move to Chile. United Kingdom was a member of ESO in the early years, but they declined to go to a Spanish-speaking country. So they left ESO and rejoined only many years later. So that was the first Brexit as far as ESO is concerned.
Yes.
They actually went to Australia to join forces to build a telescope there. So you need good weather, you need clear skies, and you need image quality. Mm. In the very latest, say, stage, you may also consider how rapid fluctuations there are in the air. And that has to do how you construct what is called adaptive optics, how you can construct devices to compensate for atmospheric turbulence. This you need to do. I mean, if things can be done in 3 milliseconds, it's easier than if it has to done in 1 millisecond.
Mm.
So after La Silla, that was the first, say, observatory of ESO, which was at that time in the 1960s, apparently as far north as one dared to go into the desert. Then one was exploring things further north. And there also our colleague Arne Otterberg was very instrumental in pursuing site testing in various sites in northern Chile.
Mm.
The site testing that eventually ended up on the Cerro Paranal, Paranal Mountain, which actually is amazingly close to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's only some 10 kilometers or so from the Pacific. You would think it is out up in the Andes, but it's not. It's at the coastal range. And the idea is that in this way, you have uniform temperature air coming from across the Pacific. And that air is cool because of the Humboldt current. It is cold. It's a cold cold water. It's there are beaches for swimming, but you go swimming in the hot waters of east coast of South America, in Rio de Janeiro or in Montevideo or so on. You don't go easily swimming in the cold waters of the Chilean coast. But the cold water makes the air cool and smooth, and it flows over Paranal just as if it were an island. So in that sense, it is an island in the ocean of air.
Wow, okay.
And that is where the very large telescope, the VLT, is placed. And the new extreme large telescope is being built nearby on a slightly higher mountain on the Cerro Armazones that is some 20 or so kilometers away.
Mm. And I guess that's also why we have La Palma, I guess. You have this western wind coming in, as you say.
Exactly. You have the trade winds coming across the ocean, and they are pressed over the hydrodynamically shaped island.
Yeah.
And then when you are at the summit, you have a very thin layer of disturbed air, and you build a telescope dome and you stick your telescope out to this disturbed layer, and voila, there's the universe.
Amazing. So I was thinking, to sort of wrap up a bit, you've been at London Observatory for a longer time than I have, so I was just curious if you have any good stories about astronomy that's been done here that I should know about.
That you should know about? Well, we can highlight, continuing on this discussion with ESO, for several years, Lund was actually one of the world centers for research on future telescopes.
Oh.
And today we read one is building the Extreme Large Telescope of ESO in Chile. It is now only a construction project. But if we go back 20, 30, whatever years, it was not clear how one would at all be able to build such a telescope.
Mm.
It is actually very challenging physics in there. For example, the problem of so-called adaptive optics. That means you're correcting the atmospheric turbulence in real time to get a sharp image. So you have to measure the atmosphere. Now, how big is a telescope? 40 meters, say. Okay.
Yeah.
What is the wind speed? 10 meters per second, perhaps. That's a hefty wind.
Mm-hmm.
That means that for a disturbance in air to cross the mirror takes 4 seconds. 4 seconds to cross 40 meters of a mirror. That means that one edge of the mirror will see a very different atmosphere than
right.
the other side of the mirror. And that means you better know what you're doing mm-hmm. if you want to correct this in real time. So there was a lot of research about these things, and that culminated in a way with a design for a 50-meter telescope called the Eura 50 that was one of the two alternatives that were chosen between for ESO's choice of what was then called the European Extremely Large Telescope, mm. now just called ELT. And the main designer there was, again, Torben Andersen, the one with the Kodiak Solar Telescope we discussed a few minutes ago. And generally, that telescope would have been superior in performance. For example, it would have permitted measurements of polarization, which you cannot do with the ELT because it has many angled mirrors and so on. But it was technologically too challenging. It was deemed as too difficult to construct. And so in the end, the ELT design was made. But there was a lot of progress made. And one of the sort of curiosities in the context is that there are parallel applications in ophthalmology, that is medical studies of the eye of adaptive optics. And some people who did their studies here, they've continued in medicine and in mm-hmm. medical companies. For example, if you the problem of correcting the turbulent image degradation in air, so you get a sharp image on your telescope, is equivalent in a way to correcting the distortion inside the human eye because of the turbid liquid in the eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not tried it myself, but I've spoken to people who have tried such an adaptive glasses, if you wish,
mm-hmm.
to look at maybe a point source like a bright lamp in the distance, a white lamp.
Mm-hmm.
But when you add this, it doesn't look white. It
okay.
flickers between red, green, and blue because it's so well focused on the retina that the rods and cones, I mean, the sensitive elements
oh, wow.
in the retina, they are resolved. The eye is designed to be slightly distorting.
Mm-hmm.
But it has maybe the more obvious application, not to look at funny things, but for a medical doctor to look at the retina under high magnification to see what there is and maybe do some laser surgery or other. So those were the times of telescope design,
mm-hmm.
and once the ELT has been finished, I believe there will be time again for the world to plan some really big telescope,
mm-hmm.
because when you look over the Atacama Desert, what is striking is not how big the so-called extremely big telescope is, it is how tiny they are. They are just small specks of mirror surface in the big Atacama.
Yeah.
39 meters, well, it used to be 42. That was the answer to the size of the telescope when that was designed, but then it was downsized to 39 meters, which people argue still is 42 yards. But for something really big, we'll have something like, we need a 100-meter
yeah.
or 200-meter telescope
wow,
to begin
yeah.
with.
No,
that will be
yeah.
for the ex-Earth to be analyzed.
Right, okay, yeah. That's a nice way of wrapping it up, I think, and also to dare to dream big and plan big. So, yeah.
Make no small plans. That is a quote from George Ellery Hale, who led the construction of several telescopes many years ago. Make no small plans.
Thank you, Dainis. There are many types of astronomers out there. Some focus on understanding stellar interiors using equations and computer models. Some observe galaxies far away, and some work on developing space missions within our own solar system. There are also astronomers who apply for time on telescopes, both ground-based and space-based. And sometimes a few lucky astronomers get to travel to those telescopes and operate them for a few nights, in hopes of obtaining good data. In the fall of 2021, a team of Lund Observatory astronomers was granted time on the Nordic Optical Telescope in La Palma. Jens Hoymakers and the PhD students Nick Borsato and Bibiana Prino, together with Elin Sandvik and Brian Thorsbrough, who is a researcher here, all started planning their trip to the telescope. Going observing is always a huge undertaking, but this time it was an extra bit challenging. Not only is the team concerned about the pandemic, who may cause a lot of complications, but there's also an active volcano to worry about. The Cube de Viejo volcano started erupting in September 2021 and was active for about 3 whole months, covering the island with both ash and lava. Nick and Bibi reported that they had gotten an introduction to the telescope and the instrument, and they also explained how volcanic ash was being monitored on the mountain. Today, we get a field report from day 3 on the mountain, and we get to hear all about that first observing night.
Hey, Nick Posada here. So it's day 3, or the afternoon after our first observation night, and well, the proverbial hit the fan, basically, about halfway through our observing run. So remember that erupting volcano I mentioned last episode? Well, the wind speed dropped to 0 pretty early on in the night, which is normally good for an astronomer because, you know, having a calmer night and less wind blowing around means that you will get better data. But apparently when you have a mountain vomiting ash into the sky, eventually the sky goes black. And, well, no observing anymore, basically. To be honest, I'm a little down about it. The whole thing really kind of sucks. I really wanted this data, but luckily I have Bibi here to talk me through it. Hey, Bibi.
Hey, Nick.
How are you?
I'm not too good, to be honest.
Yeah.
You also look very down.
Yeah, I've been better. Shit night, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
How about we, like, walk through what happened? So how did the start of the night go?
I guess that's the positive part, right?
Yeah.
Let's start with something positive.
Yeah.
I would say the start of the night, it went very well. If you also look at the preparations that we did, apart from the fact that we forgot to submit our observation blocks.
Yeah.
It went very well. We managed to get our calibration files. We managed to get our sort of, how do I describe that easily? I would say all the surrounding files and observations you need in order actually to reduce your data afterwards.
Yeah.
So all the flats and biases were taken. And then we also started observing actually earlier than we expected to. I think we were 7 minutes early.
Yeah, we were 7 minutes early, so.
And yeah, it all looked nice. We got nice data in. We checked the signal to noise from time to time, and it looked all very nice.
Well, it was really interesting because we predicted what signal to noise we were going to get. And that was based off some just mathematics. And then we measured it and we got exactly what we were predicting. So that felt really good. Like we were really in control and we'd done everything right. And like even Sarah said, our night observer was like, you guys are so organized. Like she had someone coming in the next day and, well, they hadn't even said anything about what they wanted to observe. So, you know, we felt like, you know, things were going to head in the right direction. Maybe it was a bad omen, but we did have a weird call just before we started calling, right?
Yeah. That was very weird. I remember Sarah picking up the phone and was like, yeah, I'm Sarah from the north. Who's this? What is happening? And she was like, yes, we're observing. Do you want to go through what that was?
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, there's something called the WEAVE survey, which is a spectroscopy survey that's trying to measure elements throughout the galaxy in different stars. And so they're doing some experiments on setting that up. And one of the things that these telescopes use are adaptive optics telescopes, which we will probably go into and explain in a later episode. But basically, they use laser guiding. So the idea is they shoot a really, really powerful laser up into the night sky, and that helps them to track stars at a much more accurate rate and get a really, really precise, accurate data. The thing is that if you have a telescope shooting random lasers in the sky and you have another telescope trying to observe, you know, you're getting lasers in your telescope, basically. So that was a bit of a mixed bag because we sort of had to sit down with Jens and talk about like whether or not it would be an issue. And the good thing was is that one thing about lasers is they shoot at a very specific color of wavelength. So if we were to, when we were analyzing our own data, if we saw a really orange signal in our data, we could just say, well, that's just the laser, and we could cut it out, data. So it wasn't the end of the world, but maybe it was a bad omen to what was going to happen later. So anyway, we said, you know what, let's keep going. We're not going to stress too much about it. And then we started observing. And how'd you find that? Like just the effect that we were, you know, taking exposures.
I was actually observing before that in designated visitor mode.
Yeah, right.
And there I was using Espresso on the very large telescope. And there I sort of got everything as a screen for myself to actually also look at it.
Yeah.
But it was a completely different feeling to actually be in the building where it's actually happening.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. I really enjoyed it. I think Sarah was a really good night astronomer in helping us and like letting us do our thing and just be there.
Yeah.
It was really nice. I think it was a good experience, even if it didn't turn out the way we wanted in the very end.
Yeah, it wasn't like we had some, you know, commander of the telescope pressing all the buttons for us and we were just allowed to watch it. We literally were allowed to move the telescope ourselves with a guiding hand and we weren't too sure about what to do.
Yeah.
I think that was nice. It was also interesting to sort of figure, like, what do astronomers get up to when they're observing? Because we were just observing this one target for 6 hours straight. So, like, once you've set things up, the boat pretty much drives itself. And so we ended up, like, having, you know, scientific debates about certain things and, like, you know, about, you know, talking about, you know, cracking jokes. And then you sort of have all this planned work that you're going to do, that you're going to send emails out or something, and then, like, it's in the middle of the night and your brain isn't working nearly as efficiently as you'd like it to be, so, you know, it takes you longer. But it's a really sort of surreal experience, I guess. But, yeah. I will say it's a lot funner because I helped observe on my undergrad once. It's a lot more funner when you have friends around because, like, you sort of, I don't know, you make up little things to help you pass the time and, like, you know, it's a really cool experience. But, so we had a really great first night. Like, you know, the first half of the night. So, like, you know, especially the first quarter of the first half of the night, perfect. Nothing went wrong. We're bang on. We're perfect. We're the best scientists in the world. Not really, but... And then second quarter, that was when we sort of started to realize that... Well,
yeah.
So, like, how did we figure out that we had some problems there?
So we took these 500-second exposures of our target, and after these 500 seconds, you have some, I think, 50 seconds readout.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, you could really look at the data already. So you could just open it and be like, okay, this is what I've got now. So what we did was actually checking our signal-to-noise ratio all the time in order actually to be certain that nothing goes wrong. And we realized that at some point that the signal to noise was sort of going down, which means that at some point, yeah, it went very far down.
Yeah.
So we realized, okay, there must be something wrong.
Yeah. So we were getting like factors at like 100, a signal to noise of 100. So that the idea is that, like, you have like a noise, so, like, you know, something that messes, like, makes it hard for you to get an actual signal in your data, and then you have your actual signal which sits above it. So signal to noise of 100 means it's 100 times stronger than any kind of noise fluctuations that you're getting. That, like, dropped down to 20 pretty badly. And
so we realized there will not be much more signal in there if you sort of continue doing that. So we even had a discussion about, like, taking longer exposures. But then we realized, yeah, we sort of need this continuity in our data.
Yeah.
So we didn't do that in the end. And then, yeah, I guess at some point we also talked to Jens about it. And he was then also, no, don't change the exposure times. We just continue and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I guess then it was earthquake time.
Yeah, that's right. We got hit by an earthquake. Yeah. So what was the Richter scale?
4.7, I think.
Yeah, and the whole building shook. And, like, we had our image of our star in the sky, and then it turned into this big, you know, bunch of dots for a few seconds.
Yeah, it felt like one of these old TVs when you started it and you just got this white noise.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so... as we said, we lost guiding, so we sort of really lost our target during this time of this earthquake. We got it back. It was a bit of a magical moment when the earthquake stopped and we actually saw the target again on screen.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, the signal to noise was not better. And then our night astronomer actually came back from a walk and, yeah, she then told us there's too much ash everywhere.
Yeah. And, like, if you were to even walk outside, you could basically barely see any stars in the night sky because this ash was so so strong. So we basically also, we don't want to damage the mirror because other astronomers needed to use it too. And we also need to use this telescope as well. So once she said we're closing, we ran the closing down procedure and stopped for the night. And, you know, I guess, like, understandably, I was a bit sad about that. I didn't really feel like I was helping much towards the end of the night because I just sort of had to go into my own head a little bit. But it's the next morning after now. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I think I sort of lived through this already once. Yeah. I had my observations in April this year, and they absolutely did not work out. For me, it was not an ash cloud, but for me, it was wind. And I also had to deal with this quite on my own. I was really sad about this as well, and I can really understand that you're so down. And I'm also really sad. But I think we really have to keep our heads up and just hope that our next transit is going to be a good one.
Yeah. So a lot of people are saying, oh, well, maybe we can observe tomorrow. But, well, why can't we observe tomorrow?
Yeah, so, you know, planets are going around their stars, and they need a certain time to do that. So the next transit window is, in this case, I think, day after tomorrow.
Yeah.
But we didn't get that window to observe, but we got sort of our backup window, which will then be on Saturday.
Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, we just have to wait until the planet comes back in front of its host star.
Yeah. And I guess this is part of our career is that we are at the mercy of the wind and the weather and the volcanoes that, you know, we have to live with. So it's not all just, you know, beautiful stargazing. Sometimes we have to deal with some crappy stuff. But I think one of the great things about being part of this research team is we all look after each other and we all sort of checked in and made sure that we're feeling good. So I'm feeling good that I'm with some pretty great people. So. Well, we've got a bit of downtime before that happens, so hopefully we can explore the mountain a little bit, and we might check in a day or two before our next observing run to tell everybody and the listeners how that went.
And we hope we're feeling better by that time.
Yes.
Thank you, Nick.
No worries. Thanks, Bibi.
This was the fourth episode of the second season of The Meridian. It was hosted by Rebecca Forsberg and Nicholas Borsato and our producer, Anna Anadottir. Our guest today in the studio was Diana Stravins, and Bibiana Pruno assisted with the field reporting from La Palma. If you have any comments or questions about the show, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or via the Lund Observatory Twitter account. In our theme at the beginning of the show, we could hear the members of a research school, Astronomics Ungdom, which was held here at Lund Observatory last summer. Make sure you tune in to next week's episode when we will have Michael Way crossing our meridian to talk about his research with NASA. Thank you for listening.